First, I would like to thank the organizer for giving me this opportunity to talk in this exciting workshop. And on top of that, talking about eukaryotes, which is far beyond what's the most complex species discussed in this workshop, which are mainly microbes. But I hope in the course of this talk, I can actually show you why I am emphasizing on the term eukaryotes here, and why I couldn't basically change my title to fit to the context of this meeting. So as was mentioned in the title, I'm talking about regulatory sequences and regulatory sequence evolution. So regulative evolution has been pointed out to be very important for diversification of the species, and it's already 50 years after this article by Monod and Jacquot that after one of these Cold Spring Harbor symposiums, the discussions come about that the regulation is actually quite important and it has important roles in adaptation and diversification of the species. After that, sequencing comes about and people start looking at cross-species comparison and looking at different species and see, okay, they expected to see many variations in the coding region, but that didn't appear to be the case. So they somehow thought, okay, probably regulation is still playing the role. And there were further studies to emphasize on this matter and get further with analysis on the cis regulatory sequences. And you can look for cis regulatory sequences in prokaryotes, in bacteria, and then you go further and look at eukaryotes. And what appears to be the case is that regulatory logic and grammar is getting more complex. This is a stick or something here. This is one of those regulatory networks, somehow discussed by Eric Davidson and Sea Urchin, which in this picture I'm showing a cis regulatory sequence and the interactions with different transcription factors. As you can see, there are many binding sites and they're interacting with many different transcription factors. This is particularly not the case when you go, let's say, to bacteria or like unicellular eukaryotes. What you see there is like more simplified regulatory sequences. You see a couple of binding sites interacting with a couple of transcription factors. For example, in yeast. Oh, thanks. But you see actually these complex structures. People have been trying to understand what's the grammar and what's the logic behind this structure. So there have been many experimental studies, like looking at particular regulatory sequences, let's say for Eve gene in Drosophila, there are like many studies that they look at regulatory sequences for Eve, changing different transcription factor binding size, the affinity of the size, changing the distance between the sites, and see, okay, how the whole logic is working. Well, of course, there are so many experimental data because there are so many groups working on that. And the overall conclusion, if I want to say, is that you can change the sequence a lot and the function still remains constant. You can look between different species of Drosophila, there's huge variation in regulatory sequence. And you can look even from between Drosophila and sepsid, which is far larger evolutionary time span. So it's still the same regulatory sequence of Eve work in the other species. So you can do all this transgenic analysis. And this is something amazing because it's a very complex architecture, and it somehow stabilizes the phenotype that you're observing, which is the expression of the gene that, well, it's presumably the relevant phenotype here. I'm not saying that this, you can change whatever you want and you still get the same expression, and then you can evolve that sequence. That's not the case. So there are not many evolution experiments, let's say, in that time. But we know that we can manipulate the sequences and still get the same function. Well, if this situation is highly entropic, that I would expect there are so many pathways as well that you can actually evolve these sequences. But this needs to be shown, of course. And apart from this, so there are high quality databases on regulatory information, which is actually a very good thing that we can do sequence analysis and try to understand evolution of these basically elements in the genome. A little bit more quantitative, if I want to somehow start from E. coli and going to Drosophila and look at how this complexity evolves. What we can see is that the genome length is increasing, the number of genes is also increasing, but not as fast. And if you think about regulatory interactions, it's the case that you need transcription factors. They interact with certain binding sites. The binding sites should have certain affinity. So the transcription factor should recognize the size with some specificity. And if you want to identify a specific site in the sequence for that transcription factor, like very simplistic information theory analysis give you that, you need information content, which is like in units of bits, as a logarithm of the length of the genome. This is the minimum information to identify a unique object in the sequence of n base pair. Well, let's see what's the minimum information in these different species that we have. So for E. coli, given the length of this genomes, we need 12 bits in yeast as a unicellular eukaryote, 23 bits in Drosophila, 27 bits. There are analyses of the transcription factors as well, so you can somehow map some binding sites of a transcription factor to a distribution and basically compute the information content or the specificity of certain transcription factor. That's a measure that, well, how specific should a binding site be that the transcription factor recognizes. On average, in yeast, in E. coli, what you see as information content of the transcription factors is between 20 to 27 bits. Well, this is presumably enough to recognize certain objects in E. coli. If you go to yeast, so the information content drops. And it's somehow marginally okay. If you think of the naked DNA of yeast, so it's sort of covered by nucleosomes, for example, there are more interactions, so it's somehow an underestimation, but still, it's lower than log n that we expect, but presumably one or two binding sites will work for that. But in Drosophila, the difference is huge. And basically, it means that a certain transcription factor just can't find one binding site in the genome, which we expect. And the strategy that somehow the genome took was, instead of one binding site for one transcription factor to regulate a gene, it just starts with a modulus of binding sites. So you have a series of binding sites in Drosophila as opposed to yeast that you have two or three binding sites and different transcription factors. This somehow gives rise to this complex regulatory grammar and complex regulatory structures with, well, certain interacting factors with each other and with the sequence. Well, there's a very nice review from von der Leyen Minini about this analysis and information theory analysis in Trends in Genetics. Now, it's 2 years ago, and they somehow discussed this concept there.
You're saying that in E. coli, although you need only 12 bits to be uniquely determined, mm-hmm. they all have 20 to 27 bits in reality.
The point is, it's so that the bits that you compute is basically from the observed binding sites, right? You have lower counts of the observed binding sites in E. coli, and they are longer, and you have higher specificity because, let's say, out of three binding sites, they're more or less identical, then you get more specificity. Yeah. But yeah, so that's more or less the argument. And the regulatory logic in E. coli is different. So you have so many feedback loops, so self-regulator in E. coli, which doesn't exist in that scale in yeast or in Drosophila. So now the question that I want to ask is, how does this complexity evolve? And how actually you make these cis-regulatory modules with many binding sites? Well, the simple question is how to make one binding site, and that that's the thing that I want to answer. So about evolving complexity, there are, like, people have different theories for that, and one of the main things that people discuss about this is this duplication, or whole gene duplication by Michael Lynch. And what happens as a result of this gene duplication, and how can you make diversification through this gene duplication? So this was proposed for beta to evolve genome complexity. So let's assume that you have a gene, it duplicates, and you have two copies of this gene in the genome. So one possibility is that one of the gene keeps a function, still remain functional, and the other one loses its function. One less likely scenario is that one of the duplicates actually start new function, and that's what we call nil functionalization, which is not very common in eukaryotes in particular. And there is subfunctionalization, which if the gene has like two functions, let's say you're looking at regulatory region, you have one regulatory element one place, one another regulatory function somewhere else, and then you divide the gene, one of them take one function, the other function, and you get modularity in the genome. So these two cases are the common things in eukaryotes, but as a result of them, what you will have, if you think of regulatory sequences, if you continue this gene duplication, what you should observe in regulatory sequences is like lower level of complexity, because you lose regulatory inputs in the genome, regulatory inputs per gene in the genome, and that's important. So what is the solution? So in principle, I told you that we have a high level of binding site turnover, let's say in eukaryotes. Binding site turnover is loss and gain of binding sites. With this scenario, we can actually lose binding sites, but we still need to gain certain binding sites. So how to build a binding site? Well, just the easy way to think about it is that you start from a gene, like random genome, you just put mutations under selection and you build a binding site. But that doesn't work quite well, that's the problem. The point is, it's for a binding site to be selected upon, and if you want to have a functional binding site, putting certain, make it functional, you need like certain specificity. And the fitness landscape for this binding sites, for the function, is quite nonlinear, and that we actually derive from the biophysics of these interactions. What this means is that if we have a very good binding site with high specificity, which here I put it, so highly functional site, and then we put mutations in this binding site to go away from this highly functional site, we lose the functionality. And well, if you think of affinity, the affinity drops very fast in a nonlinear fashion. This results in a cliff-type landscape or fitness landscape for this site, which means that if I start from a complete random sequence and I want to put mutations on the sequence to gain a binding site, I basically will spend a lot of time on the neutral regime to get into a seed sequence that can, after arriving at the seed sequence, that the selection can act upon that and make a binding size. And that's quite costly in terms of time. There are estimates for this binding site generation. If you think of, let's say, Drosophila, you need a 10 base pair binding site with certain specificity. If you want to make it by mutation rates available in Drosophila, to find the seed sequence to start a selection that the selection can act upon, you'll find that seed sequence in a region of 300 or a couple of hundred base pairs. So that's for one single binding site. Now, if you want to make those whole modules, it's quite hard, right? Because it's like 20 or 30 binding sites, they need to be at the right distance. So that seed sequence that I mentioned is basically one random seed sequence somewhere in that region. But basically, base substitution is not sufficient for making these modules. So what are the other mechanisms in the genome which are common for eukaryotic evolution that we can actually make use of and form binding sites? So this picture, I'll try to show the different mechanism in the time scales that they're acting in the cell or during the evolution. So if in a very short time scale you have a stochasticity, so if you look at between cell variation, you have so many stochastic, like let's just due to molecular interactions that exist there. There are epigenetic changes which can last for a couple of generations and can be inherited. Then you can have repeat instabilities, and that's very common in eukaryotes, that you have, let's say, short tandem repeats, microsatellites, mini-satellites, or even higher, like longer repeats. And these are like slower than epigenetic facets, but they are relatively fast mutation processes in the genome. So let's say they are 10 times faster than mutation, like normal mutation rates in the genome. Then you can have process of recombination and horizontal gene transfer. And these are basically the basis that we can, the basic mechanism that we can try to fit in our models to produce these binding sites. So in particular, this repeat instability or this microsatellites have been discussed and their influence have been discussed in the intergenic region, evolution of intergenic region in eukaryotes. They have influence on regulatory function. If you have in the promoter region of certain gene have microsatellites, then it affects a lot on the it affects the expression level of the gene. There are experimental studies on that. There's a very nice evolution experiment that actually look at the transcriptional evolvability in yeast for a gene that the promoter contains microsatellite, and so that was basically a strategy that the fast adapting yeast chose to just change the copy number in this region and adapt to the high expression that was the aim of this experimental evolution. There are statistical analysis, which was just cross-species analysis, look at the gaps in the alignment and just look at the overlap of the gaps with the microsatellites and see insertion and deletions are mainly due to this microsatellites or repeat short repeat sequences. In particular, there's a study by Sinha and Sijab, which look at which they saw surplus of insertions rather than deletions in regulatory regions of Drosophila compared to rest of intergenic. And they suggested that this process is actually hinting towards forming this new binding cells, because that was what we were lacking. We were lacking gain of the binding size, so we want new elements in the sequences. So they said that we have higher insertion than deletions, and that's due to the tandem repeats mainly, and maybe these insertions are the ones which at the end will lead to forming a binding size. But still, it's not clear because, yeah, the time scales, they don't match very well. The time scale for repeats are 10 times higher than mutation rates, but binding site turnover is more or less of the same rate of the mutation rate that we observe. So are they so unstable that they actually can't make the bindings, or are we seeing like a stabilization effect on the microsatellites which can lead to binding site formation with the rate that we observe in the genome? So the question is, can actually these indels or these repetitive sequences, as these two are connected to each other, can they infer regulatory information or not? And that's what I will discuss about in this talk. That's what we've been looking at. So let's assume that we have these repeats in the sequences, these duplications. What we expect is that we expect to see enhanced sequence similarity in this in regulatory regions or intergenic regions of the regulatory sequence. And that's basically a known phenomenon. So basically, if you look at the site-site correlation in regulatory region, there is a autocorrelation signal with a correlation length of about 100 base pair. So sequences are correlated there. But the interesting thing is that these correlated nucleotides are not distributed randomly in the genome, rather they are clusters. So we are looking at clusters of nucleotides which are occurring with certain distance from each other, and they look more similar than expected from the background. To identify these clusters, we developed a method based on information theoretical analysis, and we inferred that the characteristic length of these clusters are about 7 base pair in regulatory regions of Drosophila. And so if we plot some measure of correlation or sequence autocorrelation, in this case cluster autocorrelation, which as a function of distance in cis-regulatory modules, we observe this curve, so the red curve up here, and on the y-axis is some information theoretic measure of the similarity between these clusters. So as you see, the similarity drops at about 50 or 70 base pair, and it somehow levels off. We know that there are different entities in this sequence which can give rise to this similarity. I already discussed about microsatellites. There are binding sites, of course, in regulatory regions, and the binding sites can be for same factors, so they can look similar. But we have information about these functional entities, and we can ask which of these sequences are responsible for our signal. So we can mask repeat sequences from the whole regulatory region, and repeat sequences are about 5% of the region here in this analysis. And if we mask with them, then the signal drops to this level. And it's less than 10% drop of the signal, but the correlation length, we still see the same correlation length, more or less. If we mask for the binding site in the sequence, signal, the binding site 10% of the sequence, and the signal drops about 50%. So it means the binding sites are mainly the responsible elements for producing the sequence similarity. And if we actually meet the binding sites, we get the signal similar to the non-regulatory intergenic sequences.
So this green and red curve is really like you take any sequence from these bugs and compare it, and you will see a similarity with certain distance decaying like that. Is this really what
bugs? This one, yeah. So basically, you look in the regulatory intergenic region, right? And just like an autocorrelation signal, so it's average, right? So what you do is that you make this method identifies the clusters and non-overlapping clusters of certain length. We vary the length, and then you compute some measure of similarity, which, well, I'm not going to like.
But you don't condition on having repeats or having binding sites.
No, this is the red. The red curve is just, you know, you close your.
Right, this is clear. Yeah. But then
you meet the repeats, right? You just run. No, there are methods to identify the repeat sequences, and then you meet the repeat, and you get this signal on the repeat mass sequence. And you get this signal for binding site mass sequence. And yeah. So the main point is correlated binding site explains a substantial part of the signal, and why the microsatellites just are not the main part of the signal. But to understand, well, how important is the similarity, and what does it tell us about the past of this binding site, or the history of this binding site, we actually need an evolutionary model to study that. What I mean is, okay, let's assume that the two binding sites are similar. So there can be two different, there are two possible explanations for that similarity. First, the binding sites are for similar motifs, similar transcription factors, hence their sequences look similar. This I tried to show here. Basically, you have two different sequences completely independent from each other, and they got adapted to bind to certain factors. Different colors for different transcription factor characteristic or motif characteristics. Basically, you start from random sequence, you adapt to be a site for factor A or site for factor B. And for, I mean, these factors have certain similarity and their sequences have certain similarity as well. The other possibility is actually that there was a duplication sometime in the past. And one of the sites is a result of evolved after that duplication event. So either of the cases, so you start from a random sequence, you gain, let's say, a binding site for factor A. And then you duplicate this site, and the evolution continues. Here we want to make a factor site for factor B, and here we continue with factor A. And what we see here is that there is a redness in the blue color here, which shows the enhanced sequence similarity due to the common ancestor sequence. So either the duplication was from B to A or A to B. And we want to distinguish between these two scenarios. Of course, this doesn't show enhanced sequence similarity compared to the motif, and this shows enhanced sequence similarity compared to the motif. That's the main goal. And, well, to compute the likelihood of the two scenarios, the likelihood of two scenarios for each pair of binding sites, we need to compute these probabilities. Let me just walk you through it. So it's quite easy. So if for independent ancestry, we assume that the distribution of sites for each factor are under equilibrium. Hence, the sites that we observe are coming from this distribution, let's say, motif distribution. And we just compute the probability that we observe these sites for these factors here. The other scenario, we assume that there is an ancestor sequence and we don't know what is the ancestor, so basically we sum over all the possible ancestors at some point in the time in the past, let's call it tau, and then we, after duplication from that ancestor, start the adaptation process, and then we will model this adaptation and compute the propagators basically to start from a certain ancestor and arrive at the current state of the sequence. I'll go through the how we compute these things in next slide. But as a result, we can get the joint probability of these sequences under duplication scenario, and then we compute we compare these two by log likelihood score. And if the score is positive, then it means that it's more likely to have a shared ancestor, and if it is negative, it's more likely to have an independent sequence ancestor. Okay? So this is the way that we somehow use a very simplistic evolution model for computing the, for modeling the adaptive process from certain from a sequence ancestor to the current state. We use a fitness model, a fitness landscape used by Bruno Holpen for protein evolution. And it's basically an additive fitness landscape, and it's related to the sequence frequency of the sites for each transcription factor. So you have all the binding sites of a transcription factor, you make a position weight matrix for that, and then you relate it to a fitness landscape just representing the over-representation of sites of that sequence. So you have a Q distribution, which previously was this motif distribution described here, and it's related to the background distribution of that sequence with the fitness value, which is scaled with the population size. And then after that, we have mutation selection and genetic drift in this evolution, and as a result, for a regime of mu n much smaller than 1, we get a substitution rate from Kimura, and we can compute for each pair of binding sites what this probability is and what this one is. Okay, so these are this is the result that we had from an analysis of Drosophila data. So Drosophila is rather luxurious situation because there are databases for binding sites and functionally verified binding sites in Drosophila. And you can pick all the binding sites and look, okay, are the close by binding sites similar to each other or not? That's the question that we ask here. So we took this 306 site pairs in Drosophila that has a distance less than 50 base pair, and that's what I'm showing here. And this is the distribution of, so the color distribution, the histogram for the scores of these site pairs in Drosophila. So the average of this histogram is positive, is 1.3. But you might say, okay, it's not that significant, so 1.3. But the point is, there are many sites with positive score. So the sites are quite short. So you can't actually tell significance for a single site. But now that we have some of all these scores, some of this 398 out of this 306 site first. So basically, we are dealing with a biased dice, which means that, okay, it's a generic mechanism that's acting there. And that's somehow a likely mechanism that responsible for forming this binding size. So basically, we are seeing evidence for site duplication as a common history there. We can look at the score as a function of distance, so how this sequence similarity actually behaves as a function of distance between the binding sites. And what we see is that we have somehow a decaying function somewhere in agreement with our autocorrelations that we observe from the site similarity, binding site similarity. For control, what we can compare is compared with yeast. We have the data for yeast as well, and we knew that in yeast we are not seeing clusters of binding sites. So probably it's not a mechanism which is required by yeast to form binding sites. Are we seeing evidence for duplication in yeast? And the answer is no. So the full distribution is the distribution of the sites, and this dashed line distribution is basically randomly picked sites in yeast, and we compare it, and these two are more or less identical. And there was a significant difference between the two distributions for Drosophila. So this observation somehow suggests that site duplication or sequence duplication are basically a primary mode for forming binding sites. And this is not large scale duplications that was suggested by Lynch. Rather, it is a small scale duplications happening there. Presumably, mechanisms like microsatellites or other types of repeats are responsible for that. The interesting point here is, as I show here, I mean, these two are not necessarily similar transcription factors. So you don't have necessarily similar bindings of the same factor sitting close by. But our signal shows that basically, even though the transcription factors are not identical, we see an enhanced sequence similarity. It was a bit puzzling in the beginning, but what we observed was basically that the transcription factors tend to look similar as well when they have a similar binding size. So this is the point here. So it has a feedback on the regulatory grammar, more or less. So we don't know whether in the beginning the transcription factors which need to act together, should they be similar, hence their sequences are similar, or is it the mechanism that can produce a binding site and hence the regulatory grammar is dictated upon that mechanism. So we don't know what is the result and what is the substrate of this. But what so far we've argued is that we can somehow explain this asymmetric life cycle of the binding sites. In the beginning, I told you that making a binding site is rather hard. When losing a binding site is easy. You make two or three mutations and the binding site is lost. So by this mechanism, we are suggesting this life cycle, which is we form a binding site with local duplications, hence we make clusters there. And then we adapt these seed sequences by point mutation. So there's adaptation going on there, and presumably some optimization in the relative distance by other mechanism. This need to be explored further. And so conservation with rate of binding site turnover by some stabilization, stabilizing selection, and then we can get lose binding site by point mutation, which was in the beginning not a problem. Yeah, so this is basically our proposal somehow for how to make binding site clusters in regulatory modules of higher eukaryotes. So how to solve the problem of not finding, so not making like batteries of binding sites there. But well, if you think of these regulatory modules and regulatory structures, the thing that comes very naturally after that is that we are dealing with series of binding sites there, which are, let's say, number of binding sites, and they have to act together to show us certain expression level in the cell. And in principle, we need to go from single site picture to many site picture. And that's what I want to continue in this one. So it's basically very natural to go from single particle to many particle analysis here. For this study, I'm going to look into yeast because it's just far easier. But in yeast, as I told you, there are not many of these like modular structures. But what is happening there is cooperation between strong and weak binding sites, and which are dominant. And there was a study 2 years ago that for certain transcription factor in yeast, the MYC1 transcription factor, which is a repressor, they look at synthetic regulatory. They synthesize regulatory sequences for this MYC1 and change the distance of different MYC1 binding sites and binding sites of MYC1 and different transcription factors, and they look for the expression. And what they found is that the MYC1 binding sites, first of all, they cooperate with each other. So that's what is shown in this figure. So the blue line is the x-axis is the number of MYC1 binding sites that they put in the promoter. This is the repression level. And the blue line here shows the level of repression for in different promoters with different number of MYC1 binding sites. And they try to fit different Hill functions to this plot that is shown here. And the green line shows the Hill function with coefficient 1. And what they observe is actually the best fit is coming from Hill coefficient 3.4, which suggests a cooperative binding of MYC1s. Yeah, so this is one observation. And they then look for changing the affinity of this MYC1. So they look for whether the weak binding sites and the strong binding site, how different they are and how cooperative they can act with each other. So obviously, if we just look at one weak MYC1 binding site, it represses weaker than the strong site. That's what the name suggests. But in cooperation, if you put two strong MYC1 binding sites, and then you put one strong MYC1 plus one weak MYC1 binding site, the level of expression don't vary much. That's the point. So here it's comparing, so this is the expression of one strong site versus the expression of two strong sites. And this is repressor, so you need to have a repressed action. Basically, the one strong site is acting weaker than two strong sites, obviously. But one strong and one weak is acting as good as two strong sites. So this means that, okay, cooperation is good enough that you actually don't need to produce two strong sites. So what this tells us is that we can actually now look in yeast instead of complicated Drosophila and look at this many-body interaction, because we have many of these weak binding sites in yeast that cooperate with the strong site, and look at the evolution of these entities. So look at the evolution of, let's say, 100 or 200 base pair as one entity. The first thing to look at is, so are we seeing compensatory evolution in these regions? What I mean by compensatory evolution is that, let's assume that you have two strong binding sites. Well, let's assume you have one strong binding site, and then you look in the vicinity of this binding site, and there are different weak sites. You look into in two species, so Paradoxus and Cerevisia in this case. So in the same region, you pick the strong functional sites, which is conserved, and you look, so how the weak sites surrounding this strong site, how they are evolving. In this picture, what I'm showing is just somehow trying to show what I mean by stabilizing selection. So if we need certain affinity in the whole region, and one weak side starts getting stronger and the other weak side gets weaker, such that the whole affinity is conserved, so we are looking at this many-body interaction and looking at this quantitative trait. Are we seeing evidence for this type of evolution or not? So the way that we analyze this this data is basically through some statistical analysis for a certain transcription factor called RAP1, and this is the way to go. So I'm talking about the weak binding size in the vicinity of a strong binding size. So there are around 50 genes which are regulated by the RAP1 transcription factor. And they have a strong, so they have around 70 strong, functional strong binding sites there. So we fix all the strong binding sites as, like, so this is the zero of our coordinate, and we look at the vicinity of this strong binding site. The color code shows the difference between affinity of each position in Paradoxus and Cerevisia. So you pick a site in Cerevisia, you pick a homologous site in Paradox, so that basically at that position in the alignment, and you just ask what's the difference in the affinity of the transcription factor which is bound there. But that gives some delta E as the binding energy of that position, and you're just making all positions in the vicinity of this strong binding site. So if the evolution of these sites were to be independent, it means that, okay, if I look at variations of as a function of distance, variation in different genes as a function of distance of certain position, it should be independent from the variations at another distance in along this promoters. If they were to be dependent, correlated, it means in a way that if this one goes stronger, the other one goes weaker, what we should see is that, okay, if we sum over all this delta E's in the x-axis and then look at the variation should be reduced. So that's the way to go. So basically, we compute the sum of the variances of these delta E's and variance of the sums of these delta E's, and we ask, is the sum of variances larger than the variance of the sums?
What is a rho again?
Okay, so this is basically, you can think of it as one promoter, or, well, 100 base pair around the strong binding site. This is the rho. The column is basically, the point is we have 70 genes that have a strong, 70 segments have a strong site at this position.
So each rho corresponds to one strong binding site.
So this is one strong binding site. Each row corresponds to the flanking region of the one strong binding site.
When you have a black point, that means it's the strongest strong binding site?
No, it's a delta is small.
Oh,
so this is delta E, the color is delta E, sorry. So basically this is strong, the delta E is more or less zero because they're both strong. And then in the weak size, one can go higher and one can go lower. It can be positive and negative. And you just compute the variance. And we are interested in, I mean, it might just sound not very reasonable to put all these promoters on like on top of each other because they are not related. But the point is, we are looking at distance dependence, and that's something common between all of them.
So how common is it to have a couple of strong binding sites in these?
You can have two or three strong bind. Well, for this
maximum,
next to each other. But the point is, not all of them are functional. And not all of them are conserved when you look at them. Most of the time you get one conserved functional site. This is just also one transcription factor or something. Yeah, so this is the result of this analysis. So basically, just as a function of distance, you compute this variance, and sum of variance is variance of the sum, and it's divided by the length that you have because it adds up, right? And what you see is that up until like around 100 base pair, there's a significant difference between these two, suggesting that that we are seeing actually compensatory evolution between the sites in the flanking region of about 100 base pair around this. Well, so the data or the energy matrix that we used was from the Mitomi experiment by Sebastian Merkel's lab. So that was basically the single site map from the sequence to the phenotype here.
What is the blue and red curve?
Again? One is the sum of variances and the other variance of the sum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, the point was basically what we've seen here is, in the first part, we saw that binding site clusters were formed by local duplication. We could explain the asymmetric life cycle of this binding site in this scenario, and then we also argue about the adaptive advantage of these site duplications in Drosophila, due to the underlying grammar there. And we saw that it's not prominent mode for yeast. So for analysis of the yeast, I didn't put that slide here, but what we are doing now is basically looking at the whole promoters as single entities and defining phenotypes for a single promoter rather than just single site. Basically, what I mentioned is going from single particle to many particle statistics. And this is the result of the evolution is basically highly epistatic and linked genome in yeast. And so basically we are looking at this quantitative trait evolution, which is quite exciting. And I would like to thank Michael Lessig, so my supervisor, and we did most of work together, and then Willem Mustonen for the discussions about these projects, and Sebastian Merkel provide us with the data of this RAP1 transcription factor, our collaborators for this quantitative trait analysis in yeast, which I actually didn't talk about, but I forgot to. So in Leuven and the fundings. Yeah, thank you.
What sets this 100 base scale? Is it dependent on organism, or do you think it will be? I mean, there's obviously some dependence on organism.
There is also, I think, molecular constraints. So basically, the cooperation of the factors, they have some range of cooperation. And basically, the size of the genome and how promoter is close to this time, so how vast you can go and still have space to work upon. So I don't have other estimates for this 100 base for regime for the other species that I can compare to, but...
So genome size would depend on genome size, that would depend on...
The genome size will affect the architecture, definitely, and then the architecture, the underlying architecture is somehow manifested in this plant scale that we are seeing, so... There are definitely physical constraints that the factors need to cooperate or need to bind together if you have cooperative binding. But yeah, so this is basically an effective length that we're seeing on top of all.
So I'm still puzzled by this black curve in the first part of your talk. What is the reason why? The sequence similarity of any part of sequence. So what is the reason for that? Or did I misunderstand? So you said that you take any two windows of DNA, you compare it, and you detect the similarity towards the nearer they come.
No, it's like an autocorrelation, right?
Write down the function.
I mean, the autocorrelation is easy, right? So what you can do...
Autocorrelation of what, I think, is what's confusing people.
What?
I think what's confusing people is autocorrelation of what?
Yeah, okay, it's a nucleotide-nucleotide autocorrelation, right?
Yes.
So what you see is that P of, like, A and A, I plus L, right? This somehow gives you some autocorrelation, then you sum over all. This is normal autocorrelation, position autocorrelation, right? And what we do here is that we are looking at clusters, not nucleotides. And then what's the similarity between the clusters? Now you can think of it as a rescaling of the sequence. Instead of looking at this nucleotide, the distance L, and then just scanning the genome with this thing, now you look at the clusters here, scanning the genome with clusters. Now you need to have more to be more sophisticated because the clusters shouldn't overlap together. That's the reason
And you still do this at the places where the regulatory modules are?
We still do it in the regulatory modules.
But you said you depleted it for repeats and you depleted it for binding sites, but you still don't look at any random sequence. You still
look at the random sequence, and that was one of the curves. That was the black curve.
There's the one.
Okay, this is the non-regulatory intergenic.
Non-regulatory intergenic.
Right, and if you delete them,
but that is
binding sites, you get the green curve, which was somehow.
Right, but and what's the reason? Why is there any signal in the black curve? Or
well, that's the way that we define that information theory. But I mean, this is not exact. This is not the exact similarity, autocorrelation, and then there are like high AT constants, high, there are other stuff.
So that is basically more or less your null model then, the black curve.
Well, it depends, I mean, there is signal there, and there are definitely some similarity with certain length scale of 7 base pair there, but yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, our tandem repeats also outside of regulatory regions.
Right. Okay.
And there are like nucleosome, recognition size and this AT content in the nucleosome for that.
Okay. True. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Okay. Going back to first transparency, we don't need to go back. The relation that the similarity between the coding regions of the chimp and the human is about 95%.
Sorry.
The similarity between the coding regions genome of the chimp and the human is 95 or 99.
So
can you say anything about the similarity between the regulatory regions of these two species? That was essentially motivation.
Yeah, it's far less. I don't have the number on top of my head.
But you have an idea?
Maybe Christian? I think it's around 90. And there's nothing, but it's far less. I don't know exactly. Yeah. The point is that the annotations of regulatory sequences is human and chimps are not, I mean, they're not well annotated, that's another problem there. So, I don't know a number, sorry.